This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. With the 10th anniversary of September 11th on Sunday, we'll get the perspective of Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind. The La Crosse Democrat was not only in Washington, D.C. that day, but subsequently he voted on and has been privy to national security information related to terrorism since then. But first, I talked with Kind about the idea that congressional Republicans could ask for more spending cuts later this month as another deadline in the nation's debt ceiling draws nearer.
I would bet on it happening because they are literally Johnny One Note right now, and it's just cut, 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 regardless of consequences, regardless of the policy consequences and that. And I think it can lead to disastrous results for our nation. There are certain fundamental things that your government has to do, that we as a nation need to be investing in. Now, I also believe that there are room for further cuts in the federal budget. There is a lot of redundancy and waste in a lot of the programs. But to be honest with the American people, you have to go where the big money is. And the largest and fastest growing area of spending is rising health care costs. So if they're really serious about fiscal management, then they should be serious in working with us in dealing with health care reform and what we can do together to bring those health care costs down. Because nothing else is going to matter. I mean, if we don't address the rising health care costs, which is blowing a hole in our budget right now, a lot of it's due to the aging population, and Medicare, Medicaid, those type of programs, then anything else we really do with the budget isn't going to matter because it's going to overwhelm us. So I think the number one priority, if you're serious about fiscal responsibility, is health care reform, changing the way health care is delivered, but especially how we pay for it. And I think that's really going to be the key at the end of the day. Right now, we pay based on volume of services given, regardless of results. That's bankrupting us. We're spending close to one out of every three health care dollars on things that don't work. They're not improving patient care. So we have to change the incentives, and by paying for value, you can do that. And that's exactly what our healthcare providers in this region have been calling for many, many years, a value or outcome-based reimbursement system, which is what they're practicing. And the reason why they're one of the lower reimbursed areas in the entire nation because they're not practicing volume medicine like other regions are. So to get at that $800 billion a year of wasted healthcare spending is really going to be the key to getting our budgets in order, not just in Washington, but I think a large part of what was driving the state budget was rising healthcare costs too. It's one of the reasons why the governor went to the public employees and said, you got to contribute more to your healthcare plans. But that's only treating the symptom and not the disease. The disease is rising costs. Otherwise, we're always going to be going back to working families saying, you got to pay more, got to pay more, got to pay more. And that's no answer. Got to reform a healthcare system and expect a better value for our dollars. And also, let's face it, defense spending has to be on the table, and too many of my Republicans take it off the table. And yet the Pentagon keeps telling Congress every year, stop appropriating money for certain weapon systems that they don't want, they don't need. These are old Cold War relics that were better suited for Soviet mechanized divisions rather than terrorist threats. And there's substantial savings that can be had in the defense budget, too, that too many of my colleagues in Washington take off the table, and they're not being realistic. But to truly have a balanced approach, we also need to take a look at the revenue side of the ledger. And Warren Buffett is right. I think the billionaires have been coddled in this country. It is wrong that someone in his position is paying an effective tax rate of 17%, which is lower than what most working families are paying here in the state of Wisconsin. That's not fair, and that's not balanced. And it's also wrong that virtually every small business in western Wisconsin is paying a higher tax than Fortune 500 companies like General Electric. And that's because the tax code is riddled full of loopholes and credits and deductions that you need to hire a legion of accountants or lawyers to take advantage of. Most people can't. So we've got to simplify and reform a tax code that's turned into a monstrosity and has led to the imbalance or unfairness of what's being done in our country today.
So some of these solutions that you brought up, do you think any of those will be seriously considered within this super committee, the committee that's been charged to reducing the debt? Or do you think it's just going to be another ongoing battle like the most recent debt ceiling?
Well, you know, the fundamental question that has to be answered up front, I think, and answered right away, is whether or not revenue is going to be a part of the budget mix. And again, virtually all of my Republican colleagues in Washington said no revenue increases from anywhere for any reason. End of story. And that's just unrealistic because all of the bipartisan fiscal commissions that have been formed over the last couple of years have been coming down on the side of spending reductions, but also a little bit of revenue in order to reach balance again. Because revenue right now is at a 60-year low in our nation, 14.5% GDP. where historically it's closer to 19-20% GDP. And again, when the wealthiest 2% is paying an effective tax rate of 17%, the lowest in our nation's history, I don't think it's realistic that you can just balance the budget with spending cuts alone, unless you propose a budget that they did, which is getting rid of Medicare, privatizing it, turning it into a private voucher program, and doubling seniors' out-of-pocket expenses. But when seniors saw that plan, they didn't like it, and they rejected it. And the Ryan plan is on its heels right now and has no way of passing the United States Senate, or their proposal to privatize Social Security. 70% of the seniors in western Wisconsin rely on Social Security as their main or primary source of retirement income and security. So privatizing that and putting that money into the stock market, given the wild volatility that we've seen in the stock market, is a very bad idea. And yet that's another idea that they have. And then the deep cuts that they're proposing in education, scientific research, infrastructure investment, you know, these are the building blocks that we have to be investing in for long-term economic growth and job creation. Yet those are the first areas that they're going to for huge spending reductions at a time when other countries like China, Brazil, and India are making major investments in their education and infrastructure system so that they can be on the cutting edge of new scientific and medical and technological discoveries and breakthrough. I mean, I really, you know, fear if this policy continues that we will be jeopardizing our status as the most competitive and most innovative nation in the world. That just doesn't happen on its own. There has to be some investment in these areas, but I think too many of my colleagues are just going there for deep cuts regardless of the consequences.
So have you had many conversations with fellow Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan about Medicare and just your different thoughts on what will best work for people in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I have. You know, Paul, you know, is a friend. I have a good working relationship with the Wisconsin delegation as a whole, so we do have conversations from time to time. But, you know, the recent conversation I had with Paul was, unless we reform the way healthcare is delivered and how we pay for it, just cutting funding for it is no answer. You're just shifting the cost then. And you're shifting the cost on the backs of people who can't afford it. And that's not going to be fair. And they're probably going to have to go without health care coverage until they get really sick or really injured. Then they do get in, and the costs are much greater then. And if they don't have insurance themselves, those costs get passed on to everyone else. So what he's proposing really is no answer at all, other than trying to make the numbers add up in the budget with deep cuts. And that's why I've been working very closely with our health care providers back home here, because I think they've developed models of care that are highly integrated and coordinated and patient-focused, that's producing some of the best results in the entire world, but at a good cost, too. And that's what we should be duplicating nationwide.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is U.S. Representative Ron Kind. He's a Democrat from La Crosse that represents Wisconsin's 3rd District. You recently visited Israel.
Yes.
And you, along with a number of lawmakers from Washington. Can you talk about the purpose of the trip and maybe what you got out of it?
Well, it's obviously a very crucial geopolitical area for us in the entire world, the Middle East. And all roads pass through the Israeli-Palestinian conflict throughout the Middle East. And the conflicts we see over there, the sectarian strife, a lot of that is rooted in that conflict. There is a concern coming up next month that the Palestinian Authority will be going to the UN for a declaration of statehood without negotiating directly with Israel, which won't work, I don't think, because it's going to have to be a bilateral negotiation between the Palestinian people and Israel in order to reach a dual state solution. But if they go forward on the UN resolution, it may set expectations up so high that it could renew violence in that region. And that's the last thing that we need right now. So the purpose of the trip was go to speak with the Palestinian authorities, President Abbas, and also Prime Minister Fayyad, along with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and his cabinet, to see what it's going to take to get the two sides to talk and start negotiating with one another. That's the only way we're going to find lasting peace in the region, is for there to be a meeting of the minds. But you're not going to get a meeting of the minds unless the minds are willing to meet. And that was the reason why we sent a delegation over there with myself and Steny Hoyer and a few other members in order to see what we can do to kind of bridge the gap that's existed over there. And let's face it, Israel is a close ally of ours. They are a democratic nation. They're a beacon in that region, but they are surrounded with a lot of volatile forces right now. What's happening in Egypt, the Gaza, with Hamas lobbing missiles into them virtually every day. They have Hezbollah to the north, just across the border in Lebanon, with over 600 missiles aimed at them. And the thing that struck me, and this was my first trip to Israel, was how incredibly small the country is and they're in each other's faces. I mean, every inch matters over there. That territory is valuable, and there's not a lot of wiggle room involved. And so in order to find a dual state solution, which is the only logical conclusion to the conflict that's existed for too long, is going to require a lot of hard negotiations and, again, the element of give and take and compromise to reach a final agreement.
But that seems to be what the conversation's been for years now, is that we'll have to find, you know, a middle ground, a common ground, but what's it going to take? I mean, will Israel have to give a little? Will Palestine have to give a little?
Well, what's going to have to take is, I think Israel will have to give up some of the territory that they're establishing settlements on right now. I think they're clearly in violation of the previous agreement in doing that. It's obviously a real thorn in the Palestinian side that they've been allowed to go forward with settlements in regions such as the West Bank, which is supposed to be Palestinian territory. But the Palestinian Authority is going to need to realize that there are legitimate security concerns that Israel has too. There's one section in Israel that's just 9 miles wide, and it's guarded by this very high plateau. So whoever controls that plateau, which happens to be in the West Bank as well, has the ability to cut Israel right in half and to lob missiles right into some of their major cities. So Israel has legitimate security needs. It's going to have to be dealt with. And Palestine has some territorial needs, too, that Israel is going to have to deal with. But the thing that does give me a little bit of hope is that there has been economic growth in the West Bank right now because of the increased economic integration of Israel and Palestine. And I think they're both realizing that they're attached to the hip when it comes to a viable economic model in the region. They're going to need each other in order to prosper. And that could lead to some better results at the negotiation if we can just get the sides talking to one another again.
I read a news report that said Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Republican members, maybe he told you Democrats this as well, that Iran remains to be the region's biggest threat. I'm wondering if you can talk about that and how much of your meeting had to do with that. And, I mean, what can the U.S. do, and can the U.S. afford to get involved with Iran?
Yeah, you know, Iran for too long a time has been a destabilizing force throughout the entire Middle East. They are anxious to develop their own nuclear capability. They have medium-range missiles now that if they arm it with a warhead can easily reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And when you have a president in Iran, Ahmadinejad, who's been saying publicly that he'd like to annihilate Israel and wipe them off the map, you got to take those threats seriously, especially when you look at the history of how the Jewish people have been treated throughout the millennium. And the Jewish people do treat that seriously. But even larger than the threat Iran poses to Israel is the escalation, the potential nuclear arms race that Iran could generate by trying to develop their own nuclear arsenal. Because the second they do, Saudi Arabia is going to want the bomb. And the second Saudi Arabia does, you got a domino effect, and other countries are going to want it. And I would submit that the world would be less stable and less secure if the entire Middle East suddenly becomes nuclearized. So it's more than just Iran developing the bomb. It's all the other countries and their neighbors around them who will feel compelled to have the same type of capability. And that's the last thing that we can afford. I mean, just look how dangerous India-Pakistan relationship has been throughout the decades, two nuclear-armed nations. And there are trip points there that are very volatile and can explode at any moment. And so having a nuclear arms race throughout the Middle East is something that Israel would like to see avoided. It's in our interest to see it avoided. And we got to figure out a way to leverage whatever pressure we can bring to bear to Iran, which is very little on our side. But the key to it is going to be Iran or Russia and China. They're the only ones with any type of leverage over Iran. And fortunately, China has been making steps recently to step up pressure on Iran to get them to back off from their nuclear program. I think it's very, very important that that's accomplished.
We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. And I think 10 years ago, just a couple days after 9/11, you were a guest on Newsmakers. I want to look back to maybe that day. Did you really think that 10 years later, that event would be carrying such a heavy influence on our daily lives? You as a congressman, me as a citizen. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, you asked some of the older generation where they were when Kennedy was assassinated. That was our moment on September 11th. Everyone, I think, who was alive at the time will remember, because it was burned into our images what happened. And being in Washington at the time and having to evacuate the Capitol and the office building, hearing the crash into the Pentagon as I did, the boom, and then seeing the black plumes arise just across from the Potomac is seared into my memory. It's something that I hope we never have to relive as a nation. But it also brought home the reality that the two oceans that have done a reasonable job of protecting us for many, many years can't anymore. The world is much smaller, and the capability of terrorist organizations to bring that to our doorstep is real. And I knew at that moment that things would be changed for our country forever. And it has come at an incredible cost. Obviously, there was a need to take away those safe havens in Afghanistan from Al-Qaeda. They had operational capability there, which was intolerable, and we had to do something. I ultimately disagreed severely with President Bush with his decision to send troops into Iraq the way he did. I felt it was important for us to get weapons inspection teams back in Iraq. But once we accomplished that, I talked to the president and wrote a letter to him, signed by 150 of my colleagues, to give the inspection teams time to do their job because they weren't finding anything. And you get that pit in your stomach that with all the intelligence that was supposedly out there, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and the inspection teams weren't finding anything, you're thinking, whoa, I mean, we better be careful before we start sending in our troops under a mistake. And I think that was a costly mistake, one that we will be paying for a very long time, not only in loss of lives and treasure, but with our standing in the region right now. And then the whole security apparatus that was created after 9/11 that we're still experiencing back home. Tremendous strain on our budget. It was a huge increase with Homeland Security and anti-counterterrorist activities that wasn't paid for. It was deficit financed. The security that all of us encounter when we go through the airport lines and that has changed our lives. So we do need to be vigilant in making sure that we do what we can to take away the international terrorist capability of delivering harm, not only to ourselves but throughout the world, but also realizing that no matter what we do, we're always going to be somewhat vulnerable because it is an asymmetrical threat. And if some bad people get some bad capability, they're capable of doing some bad things.
In a way, do you regret or do you still stand behind when you decided to support the initial invasion to Iraq?
Well, I supported the resolution that came up. But if people read the resolution, the option to use force was the last option. The primary goal that I saw in that resolution was getting inspection teams back into Iraq because Saddam Hussein had kicked them out. And when he had agreed to let them come in with unfettered access to all the sites that they wanted to inspect, that was a major accomplishment. I thought it was important that we got that done, and I didn't think we could do that unless there was a sword hanging over his head. Hey, if you don't let the UN inspection teams back in, there is the option of military capability then to force this upon you. And I think that was one reason why Saddam Hussein ultimately let the inspection teams back in his country. And then he himself started saying, well, I really don't have the stuff. I was merely saying I had it in order to keep my neighbors off my back, like Iran or like Israel. And it made sense. In fact, one of my trips to Iraq, I met with the Iraqi general in command of the defense of Baghdad. And he was in exile in Jordan at the time. And I asked him in the conversation, all right, so what was the deal on weapons of mass destruction? He said even he didn't have access to that information. But when he went to Saddam Hussein at the time of the invasion and said to him, listen, you got to tell me because I've got 40,000 troops deployed around Baghdad, and if you've got chemical weapons or if you're going to deploy them, I need to know in order to protect the troops. Saddam Hussein admitted to him that he doesn't have it. He just pretended to have it for a defense mechanism in the region, and that made sense. And why our intelligence agencies weren't putting that into the calculation, coupled with the fact that the inspection teams weren't finding anything, I think it was a huge mistake. It was a military and foreign policy blunder, and it resulted to us taking our eye off the ball. And the ball was Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda wasn't in Iraq. It was still in the Afghan-Pakistan region. That's where we should have been focusing all of our energy, including going after Osama bin Laden. And instead, the A-team was all diverted down to Iraq to deal with that country that didn't pose any type of security threat to us or anyone else, we now know.
So could the U.S. have captured Osama bin Laden without Iraq?
I think so, absolutely. Iraq had very little to do with our operation in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Al-Qaeda operation that we were pursuing. And we had bin Laden on his heels. We had him on the run at the time. I think another mistake that was made going into Afghanistan is we didn't go all in. We were relying on the Northern Army in order to do the job. And of course, it was going to take them much longer and allowed the Al-Qaeda to disperse. Well, we should have gone in order to cut them off, including their avenues of escape, and ended it as quickly as possible. And also made it clear to the neighboring countries that we would expect complete and full cooperation. And if they weren't going to get it, then boundaries weren't going to mean anything to us. Sovereignty issues weren't going to mean anything to us because we had to pursue the perpetrators of 9/11. And that message wasn't delivered clearly, especially to the Pakistani government.
Another result of 9/11 was the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. In your opinion, are they getting the job done? And is it another bloated government program?
Well, what took so long to do, and unfortunately, the Bush administration was not on board in doing it, was the integration of our 16 intelligence agencies that weren't talking to each other pre-9/11. I mean, it was really a smokestack type of industry where they each were operating in their own world, collecting bits and pieces of information, but no one had the big picture. And that's why the dots weren't connected in regards to the evidence leading up to the attack on September 11th. And it took a reformation of our intelligence agencies to get them all on the same page, get them completely integrated with all the turf wars that exist with the bureaucracy in Washington. And the Bush administration was very reluctant at first to do that, but we were finally able to accomplish it. So I think if there was one great achievement from September 11th was the teamwork and the coordination that we now see with intelligence capability, the gathering of evidence so we can take action. And there are a lot of examples that aren't known to the public of averting other terrorist strikes against us because of the increased capability that we now have. So we've gotten better on that front. But we also need the cooperation of other countries in order to do this with their own intelligence networks, with their own embedded people trying to penetrate those terrorist cells. We can't do this by ourselves. And I think after September 11th, that is the larger message here, that while we generally felt safer and more secure behind two oceans protecting us, the world is too small now, and we can't operate by ourselves as we've done in the past.
Democratic Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse reflecting on September 11th and talking about other current events. Also, Kind says he has not yet decided if he's going to run for Senate in the seat that's being vacated by Senator Herb Kohl, although he says he is giving it serious consideration. Coming up in the next half hour, reflections of September 11th from La Crosse's police and fire chiefs. What's changed for first responders since that day? You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. We also welcome your comments and ideas. Simply follow the links on our archives page at wpr.org/lacrosse.